The SparkFile podcast may contain profanity and other adult content.
Please use your discretion.
When I bump into something that inspires me, I jump it in my SparkFile.
SparkFile.
Could be something that I want to make or how I want to be. I pump it in my SparkFile.
SparkFile.
I jump into my SparkFile.
Welcome to the Spark File, your one-stop old-timey shoppy for creative inspiration.
I'm Laura Camion.
I'm Susan Blackwell. If you're joining us for the first time, welcome. You may be asking yourself, what exactly is a Spark File? Where do I get a Spark File? What do I file in my Spark File? These are good questions. Zach, we've got answers.
Yes, we do. A Spark File is the one place where you consistently collect all your inspirations and fascinations. And if you're like us, making shit all the time, sometimes the wellspring of inspiration can get a little dry. So we're here to refill it.
So we're on the lookout for fresh ideas, images, and inspiration that spark our creativity and pique our curiosity, things that inspire us to get up off our asses and make a things like this podcast.
Or a specialty cocktail.
Or a hand-carved ladder.
So on today's minisode, we're going to talk to someone who really sparks us.
And that special someone.
Excited.
Is Zach. Which roughly translates into Zachary Quinto. Zachary.
Hey.
Zachary. Welcome to the Spark File. Hi.
Welcome.
How are you doing?
Welcome.
ZQ, we are old friends. You and Cams are meeting for the first time.
That's right.
So we represent the full spectrum of our listenership. I know you as a real live breathing human being. Cams, you know Zach as an artiste.
I do.
So this is going to be quite a little shenanigan up in here.
Yes, it is. Yeah. So we were thinking we might start at the beginning.
Okay, bring it.
Okay.
Where are we going?
So we're going to go back.
Places.
We're going to take it back.
Yeah.
Can you give us just a quick overview, your backstory in a nutshell?
In a nutshell.
For someone who doesn't know, where are you from? Where you been?
I grew up in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
Nice.
Born? A great city, born and raised.
Nice.
It's a great city. And I had a very, I would say, traditional suburban upbringing. I was raised Catholic. I had a lot of family, pretty intact, pretty stable.
Yeah.
Until I was about 6 years old when my father got sick and died. Not great.
Oh.
Not good.
That's something.
Not good.
Not good. Yeah.
This is a, I'm jumping forward.
Really went straight to the heart of it. But I know that we talk about the sources of creativity often being moments of real trauma or real unexpected redirection of a journey of a life.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, my first 5 years of life, my first 6 years of life were like as sort of safe and comfortable and white bread as you can get, you know, really, in a lot of ways. We had great community, great family, great friends, you know, a lot of sort of the comforts of life.
Yeah.
And my parents were very happy together, and I have an older brother and all of that, you know, but this kind of event, this traumatic, unexpected, irrevocable event really shaped all of us in different ways. And I think has a lot to do with us sitting here today.
What did your parents do?
My parents come from very different backgrounds. My mom was raised very upper middle class, or lower upper class, in Pittsburgh culture, like in Pittsburgh society. Right. Mm-hmm. So her father was a successful businessman and politician.
Oh, I didn't know that.
He was in Congress. He served a term in Congress.
Wow, really?
And my great grandfather also politician. So there was like a political landscape in my mom's side of the family.
I love learning this about you, and it makes sense to me about you.
Okay.
I want to know more about that.
There's actually a roadway in Pittsburgh named after my great-grandfather called the P.J. McArdle Roadway because of his contributions to the city. And so she grew up in that way. My father grew up about an hour and a change outside of Pittsburgh in a small town called Connellsville, where his father, an Italian immigrant, had settled when he moved.
I don't know shit about you.
I think I know you, Zach.
So my father is a first generation American, and was the first of his siblings to be born here. No, that's not true. My father was a first generation immigrant and the second of his siblings to be born in the United States. His older sister was born in Italy. And so what happened was my grandfather, I mean, do you want all this?
Yeah.
You can edit it. My grandfather, my grandfather was married in Italy and had a son. And his wife and son died in the flu pandemic of 1919. And so he then,
you know, all
this. This is a there's a lot of sparks in this. Yeah, okay. Treasure trove.
I gotta ask you another question.
And then he subsequently went through that grieving period, met my grandmother, married her, had my aunt in Italy, and then left them for 6 years and came to the United States, where he had cousins who had immigrated already. He lived with them, aligned with them, and built a life for himself here, which took 6 years before he sent for my grandmother and my aunt to come join him in Connellsville, and then finished the family and had three other children, one of whom was my father.
How do you know all this?
Wow.
My dad's side of the family, my aunt who died in 2010, became the sort of de facto matriarch of my father's side of the family, and I was grateful enough to be able to learn from her.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Keeper of the flame.
Yeah, keeper of the flame.
That is juicy. Mm. There's might be a good novel.
I have to ask you, have you ever read the book Flu?
No,
it's about the flu of 1918
and how it shaped.
It is such a good read. It's one of those, like, you know, you kind of forget that it's not fiction. You're like, what the
put it in my spark file.
Put it in your spark file. Because I have a fantasy of someone like telling that story. When I read it, I was like, why do I know about the Black Plague, but I do not know that a fourth of the world's population was killed in 1918?
Here's a real-time spark. ZQ, get that screenplay made, produce and star in that movie.
Mm.
There you go.
Okay. Boom.
I want to jump ahead to jump back. When you think of your life, do you think of the death of your father as sort of a demarcation line, and there's sort of everything that came before and everything that came after that?
Yeah, it's the single most defining event of my life.
Can you talk about the after? So you told us about what it was like before. So then what started to change and what developed after?
Well, it entirely disrupted the dynamic of my family. So you asked, what my father was a very creative, very magnetic, magnanimous, loving person. Everybody loved my dad.
Like, really?
Yeah.
Like, you just posted a photo of him for Memorial Day, and you look so much like him.
Yeah.
I thought about your mom, and I thought, how must your mom feel when she looks at your face? Maybe that's changed over the years, but it's so interesting to hear. He due respect to your deceased father, a total potty, but it's interesting to hear that he was so charismatic.
Yeah,
and so
very,
magnetic.
Very, sort of a Renaissance man. He was very talented. He was a great chef. He was a great musician. He was a photographer. He was a visual artist. He drew. By trade, he became a barber and then a hairdresser later. Sort of, his career was, he ran the hair salon at Saks Fifth Avenue in Pittsburgh.
What?
Yeah, very Warren, Warren Beatty and shampoo kind of vibes.
Wow,
really? And super natty, like very like YSL kind of vibes. He was
you
a cool.
So you come by that honestly, your sartorial style.
Yeah, he was really into like how he walked through the world, and he did it. He was very tall. He was like 6'4" and a half, and big guy. Really, And my mother, so they met. It was this very unlikely union. My mom was a client of my uncle's. So when my dad opened his first salon in Pittsburgh, he owned it with his brother.
What was it called?
I don't know. That I don't know. My mom was a client of my uncle, Jerry. And one day she showed up for her appointment with Jerry, and he was out sick and didn't cancel the appointment. And so my dad cut my mom's hair.
That is a meet cute for a rom-com.
So cute.
Really?
Yeah.
How did your how did, to follow up on Laura's question, I'm curious how your dad's passing like impacted.
So my mom, who was also engaged previously, like she was sort of with somebody else.
Scandalo.
And then kind of was drawn into this, you know, and it was like not, you know, it wasn't quite a like wrong side of the track situation, but I do feel like my mom wasn't being groomed to meet and marry someone like my dad.
Like a Solano. Mm-hmm.
But it was this unlikely kind of fiery.
Dad sounds like the shit. Mm-hmm.
So they
the heart wants what the heart wants.
But I will say about my mom, you know, she was a beautiful, beautiful woman. Still is in her own way, but she never really cultivated a strong sense of self.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the interesting things about my mom, historically and family tree-wise, is that she was the firstborn daughter to her parents. She had an older brother, but she was the firstborn daughter, and so was obviously doted upon and, you know, celebrated. Mm-hmm. And she received all of the attention and affection of her father.
But big expectations, probably.
A lot of expectations. Yeah. But when you, I don't know if you know this about my mom. I think you do. On her fifth birthday, my grandmother gave birth to twin girls. So
there's a line of demarcation in a life
of like, you know, her stepping into her identity as like a young girl who is the apple of her parents' eye immediately. And in like the breath of these two babies being born, all of her thunder was stolen.
It's amazing what can change a life.
And that was the single most defining moment of my mother's life.
Wow.
If you ask me.
And at similar ages.
I was going to say right around that time.
Yeah. So my mother, I think, like, she didn't cultivate. Like, I think it really affected her in a way that, like, she felt her identity had been stripped from her, you know? And she was then, the relationship between her and my aunts was, like, always sort of triangulated and always sort of, you know, filtered through this two against one energy. And that carried with her through her life. But then the thing that I think, she met my dad, she was the older woman, you know, older sister. She was gorgeous, like truly, like,
I need to see some early pictures.
But truly, like absolutely gorgeous. And so when she met my father, like, it sort of, you know, I think she used her ingenue kind of persona to set herself apart from her sisters, even though they were beautiful and like had their own, but my mom was a little ahead of the game. So she sort of like entered into the society of, you know, dating and sort of being this like, you know, bon vivant in her own right. And so when she met my dad, she really plugged into that relationship as her source of now I am a married woman. Now I am this man's wife. Now I am. And so that was her source of identity. And so that when my father died, it was a second time when her sense of identity got completely just ripped away from her. And she was
totally. Did she ever recover from
that? No, never.
Never. How do you feel like that? How do you feel like it impacted you as a human and as a creative person?
Well, in terms of my relationship with my mother, when her identity as a wife was ripped from her, then it was replaced with her identity as a mother. And I was seven when my father died. My brother was 14, so my brother was already in high school. He was much closer to my dad than to my mom. He really resisted her presence in his life after my father died and rebelled against her, whereas I was still sort of in close enough proximity to her that the gravitational pull of her need for identity just sort of wrapped itself around me and pulled me into her orbit. So it began a very long and complicated journey for me to kind of individuate. And like, you know, I would say that had a large impact on my creative process.
One of the things I was saying to Baby Cams before we came to talk to you is I feel like you're a very articulate, very loving person, real smart, real good sense of humor. And one of the traits about you that I really admire is your ability to know, just intuitively know what you want, what you don't, and really set clear boundaries about it. Easy peasy, boop, boop. But you're saying all this stuff, and I'm like, I think you had to learn that.
Oh, big time.
To individuate yourself.
Big time, yeah. All of that is a huge. And I remember, it's a bit of a digression, I guess, but I remember being in my early 20s and in Los Angeles, and I was friends with this woman who was older than me by probably about 12 years. So she was in her 30s by this time. And I remember thinking that very thing about her and being like, how is she so clear about what she wants? And like, and I remember at that time thinking like, I got to figure this out, you know, because I was like so far.
But you were how old when you knew her? You
said I was probably in my early 20s, like 22.
So it really took that long. Like you hadn't figured it out.
I would say, I mean, I got into therapy when I was 25, 26. Mm-hmm. That's when it began. That's when the process began. Yeah. I mean,
interesting.
I don't know how long it took per se to get me to the place that I'm at now.
Still but
that's,
all figuring it out. But I just, I had been picturing when you said what you said about the age and your mom. And I'm like, oh, I was thinking this came like rooted much younger, but it's actually very inspiring and exciting to think about like, oh, no, you recognized that, saw that in your 20s and was like, I'm going to embark on this process of finding my
deep dive. I mean, in terms of how my father's death affected me, it's like as a 7-year-old, I mean, obviously the trauma of losing that primary caregiver and like, you know, it just totally wrecked any sense of natural development that I was, you know, exploring at that time. And it thrust me into this world of like, survival skills, defense mechanisms, like all these things that I switched into to survive this horrifying, unfathomable trauma. And so for me, it was like I learned very quickly. I became incredibly precocious. I learned how to observe the adults around me for guidance as to how to react to situations. Like I remember looking to the adults in a room to see how they were grieving, because I didn't know what grief was.
Yeah.
And in 1984, there was no, there was not the same degree of awareness child psychology and the well-being of children mentally. Yeah,
that's right.
To be able to like care for me through that. So I was cared for by being protected.
Right.
My family thought that like I had to be protected from the reality of my father's illness and death. And that was how to take care of me, which is the absolute opposite of how to take care of a child going through something like that.
Right.
So I was like exiled, like, you know, in emotionally and physically from the experience. You know, my parents had a friend who was a doctor who lived in Florida, and that man flew to Pittsburgh to tell my brother and me that our father was going to die.
Instead of
doing it themselves.
Wow.
Did you get to spend time with your dad as he was getting closer to death?
Did they keep you separated
because they didn't want you to see it?
It was more of an event to go visit him in the hospital as he was getting sicker and sicker. Yeah. Bad news.
So I'm getting that like you were observing the adults and even seeing how they grieved and probably, I mean, I'm imagining, tell me if I'm wrong, but like what their faces, like looking at what their faces were doing, what were the kinds of things they were saying to each other? Is that when, or when did you start? I'm curious when you started thinking of yourself as a creative person. And I wonder if there's
like a mirroring.
I don't know.
Yeah.
Well, I think it developed in me a heightened sense of observation from a very early age that probably wouldn't have been developed if I hadn't gone through that. And then also, I think the ways in which I processed the trauma ongoing were through a heightened sense of imagination and my relationship with storytelling by myself. I remember spending a lot of time alone and spinning stories by myself. So I think I can look back on it now and say that I was a creative person from a young age because creativity was a huge way that I processed through a lot of this trauma for the first few years after my dad's death, like 7 till 11, 4 years. And then at 11, that creative exploration or that imaginary kind of life was given structure by a teacher that I had.
Tell us about that teacher.
Janice Smith. my third grade music teacher
at
Fred L. Aiken Elementary School in Pittsburgh, PA.
Is she still with us?
I don't know. I have tried to find her unsuccessfully in the last few years.
You know Janice, if you're listening, Janice.
That's right.
I mean, Janice Smith was a real, I have everything. Yeah, I have her to thank for every experience that I've had.
What specifically was she, how was she supporting you or mentoring you?
She was a real eccentric, and she was one of those teachers who, she really marched to the beat of her own drum as a teacher. And she, kids can be cruel, and kids were mean to her as a teacher. They didn't treat her with the respect that obviously I think she deserved. But I did. Mm-hmm. And I sort of had this weird, it's interesting because I think throughout my life I have these touchstones of relationships with women, older women, sometimes complicated women. You know, I think it's filtered through my own mother. Mm-hmm. But she was kind of one of the first like people, you know, who I was like, I don't know why I felt really like I loved her class. I loved music. And she saw something in me. Mm-hmm. And one day after school, she sent me home with a cutout from a local newspaper that talked about these auditions for a performing group at the Civic Light Opera in Pittsburgh. And it was called the Mini Stars.
Oh.
And yeah.
Mini Stars. And
it was in a sealed envelope that she gave me. And she said, take this home and give it to your mother. Mm. And so I took it home and gave it to my mom. And it was an article with a note that said, you know, I think that Zachary could excel based on his performance in class and his, you know, response to what we're doing. I think this could be a good thing for him.
God.
Yeah, it's kind of major.
Fucking gift.
And my mom was like, whatever. And I have never performed to this point in my life. I had never taken a class. I had
but
never
you've
done
been
anything.
Doing a lot of imagination and a lot of stuff probably in private.
Sure. But I mean, I had never had, it had never been given any kind of structure. And so my mom was like, all right, do you want to do this? And I was like, sure, why not? And so she signed me up for these auditions, took me down to the Benedum Center in Pittsburgh, PA, in 1988. And I auditioned.
Do you remember what you did for your audition?
I sang "America the Beautiful."
Oh,
and literally the response that I got was, "Okay, that was really that was a good job. Why we're gonna ask you to come back next week and sing a song from Broadway?" And my answer was, "What is Broadway?"
Oh,
I had no idea.
Sweet pea.
So I went back to Janice Smith and I said, "Miss Smith, what is Broadway?" And she said, well, Broadway is Oliver. Broadway is Consider Yourself. And I'm going to teach you Consider Yourself from Oliver.
Oh, my gosh.
And I worked on it for a week with Janice Smith every day after school. And I went back and I sang it. And I got accepted into the Civic Light Opera Mini Stars.
Oh, my
Pittsburgh,
God.
Yeah,
what kind of work were you doing with the Mini Stars?
The Mini Stars were a group of, I would say, probably like 6 to 18-year-old kids of various ages and, you know, backgrounds and shapes and sizes. And we learned medleys. We sang all different kinds of medleys and performed them all around the Pittsburgh area.
Were you dancing as well as
singing? Mm-hmm. We were giving you very like white pants, white shirts, and like very colorful vests that were reversible. So sometimes you'd wear the blue side, sometimes you'd wear the purple side, sometimes you'd wear a sequin vest. And we would dance around in white jazz shoes and climb up on ladders and do a lot of jazz hands and sing Cole Porter and sing a Disney medley and sing
like
a Broadway medley. I mean, it was literally heaven on earth. It was like I found
to go to practice.
Yeah. No. I found my sort of, it gave direction to everything that would happen after that. And through that, I mean, Pittsburgh, side note, is actually an incredible city in general, but also an incredible city culturally. And for young people, you know, it's like, it's got a lot of, there's the Civic Light Opera Mini Stars. There was there's another place that I studied voice. The Center for Performing Arts. There's Ken Gargaro, who had like his own thing. Like there's a lot of like places for kids to go.
Mm-hmm.
And I was such a beneficiary of that, you know? And so I in addition to being a mini star, then of course I had to enroll in the Civic Light Opera Academy of Musical Theater.
Clearly.
So then it was like I found my way into classes.
Game on, motherfuckers.
And I encountered my second most influential teacher in my journey, who is a woman named Jill Wadsworth, who became my acting teacher from the time I was 12 till the time I was 18.
Oh shit, she did a good job with you.
She was my,
you're
a
good actor.
Sort of real mentor.
Good job, Jill.
As I came through my high school years and realized that this was something I wanted to do more.
I wanted to ask you about that while you're right there, because we also were curious, like, at what point did you go from like, yeah, I think I'm creative and maybe I'm talented? When did you start to think, oh, maybe I will make a life of this?
Well, as I got into high school more seriously, and so then I was a mini star. I think I was a mini star until I was 16. So until I was like a junior.
It's like Menudo, then you age out.
I sort of aged out of mini stars a little prematurely. I didn't stay until I was 18. I was like, at 16, I feel ready to move on. But in addition to that, I was still studying after school.
That must have been bittersweet, though. Or maybe not. Maybe you were like, see a mini star.
I'm a full grown star now.
Yeah. But I was also studying still at the academy with Jill all through high school, and I was doing like high school musicals at my school. So I was really, now all of my extracurricular time was spent in performing arts, and I was also studying. So I said to my mom at a certain point, like probably around my junior year of high school, this is what I want to do. And she was like, you're going to law school. Like, you're
kidding me.
No, she was like, you're definitely like,
here's the thing I want to say, your mom, I mean, with your pedigree and your intellect and you're so very, very articulate. I can see why your mom was like, no, but you're going to law school.
Because I was also doing like debate and I was also doing other things. And she was really, encouraging the more academic side of my interests and my skill set. But yet she saw the passion. And my mom's not.
The passion for sequin vests.
Yeah, she saw my passion for jazz shoes.
You could wear those in a courtroom.
Sure. But so she was very, she had this joke that like, you can be an actor after you're a senator. Like she wanted me to be a politician or a lawyer. And so this really interesting seminal moment of my development was, these are crazy stories, but when I was 16 years old, my mom wouldn't let me get my driver's license. She, as a punishment for every time that I talked back to my mother, she added another month onto the amount of time that I was allowed to get my driver's license.
She wasn't,
so I
like,
turned
get
16
out of
in
house.
June, and I was not allowed to get my driver's license until December because we had enough significant altercations in which I taught. And this was like when I really got to like the level
set
of
a boundary.
When I really got to a level of talk back. That was like another month. So that was like 6 months. So I didn't get my driver's license until the beginning of December of 2019, whatever, when I was 16.
Yeah.
1994. But I'm so
bad at math.
As I get older.
Don't look at me. I'm not going to be able
to help
you with
whatever
math.
Number you give. We won't do the math.
So I wasn't allowed to get my driver's license until December of the year I turned 16, was my junior year of high school. And so it was like all of this sturm and drang around me getting my driver's license. So the first night that I was allowed to take the car out on my own, I got into a horrible car accident with three of my friends in the car. And the car was totaled.
Oh, my God.
And I was driving at like in a 15-mile-an-hour speed limit zone. I was driving like 65 miles an hour, coming off an exit ramp and hit a patch of black ice and slid off the road and landed in, like, I was literally like 10 feet in front of a telephone pole and 10 feet away from like a giant tree that I had either of those,
fucking
like we all
God.
Would have died.
Oh,
it was like,
was everybody safe?
Everyone was safe. Everyone was fine. No one was injured. But my mother had to come pick us up and see the car and the smoke and the whole thing. And it was like, obviously, like this was like a crazy, like, moment. And it was in the subsequent like 4-hour conversation after we got home of like, what were you thinking? What were you doing? And like, I don't know what triggered this, but it was a moment where I was like, this is what I want to do with my life.
Perhaps a near-death experience.
Perhaps
that's
a
near-death
experience.
That'll do it.
But it was in that conversation that I sort of first declared my intention to pursue.
That was where you declared your intention?
Yeah.
Wow.
To like go to school for acting, to go to college for acting.
So many of these things that you're describing are either scenes out of a novel or a film. Mm-hmm. It's crazy how some of the stuff is so cinematic. That's like if I saw it in a movie, I'd be like, that's a bridge too far. But it's but it happened to you.
And yet true.
Sure
near death experience. Wow. And then no, I'm gonna be an actor. I'm gonna go to Broadway.
Well, dude. I'm gonna go to drama school.
Amazing.
Yeah.
And was your mom in more of a mindset to hear it in that
There
moment?
Was something about the vulnerability of what just happened, I think, that, you know, mm-hmm. made her more. So then my mom was like, well, you know, we need to get a professional opinion about whether or not you can hack it. So then my mom hired this vocal teacher, this opera teacher who was on the faculty of Cincinnati Conservatory of
Cultivated.
Music named Lorenzo Malfatti. And Lorenzo Malfatti was this like older Italian gentleman who like gave voice lessons and was like an opera. So my mom took me to this man and made me sing for him and made him tell her whether or not he felt like I was good enough to like cut it.
Oh my God.
Which thank God Lorenzo Malfatti said I was.
That kid's got juice.
And then my mom sort of slowly started to kind of come around to it. At the same time, I got accepted to the Pennsylvania Governor's School for the Arts. That was another milestone mm-hmm. moment it. Because mm-hmm. it was like, audition for this thing. If you're good enough to get in, then maybe we'll see. So my experience started to align to support my intentions and my goals and my ambitions and my desires to pursue this more seriously. Once I got into governor's school, Lorenzo Malfatti signed off on the talent card.
Thanks, Lorenzo.
And, he's going to make it.
Yeah. And then that became the sort of catalyst for me to say, like, I don't care what you say. I'm going to
I'm
drama
doing
school.
This. Yeah. I'm doing
so
it.
I made the decision to audition for
school.
Before we just move on from this time in your life, I'm just curious, what roles, just a few of the roles that you were performing
in. Give us a visual.
In high school, I was, my freshman year, I had to drop out. I forget why I had to drop out of Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat. I think I was playing the baker. And for some reason, I dropped out of that. And that was like scandalous because it was my first, it was the fall production. I think there was like a movie that was shooting in Pittsburgh that I got like sort of involved in. And I had to drop out as a result.
Okay.
Yeah, I think it was Lorenzo's Oil, in fact. I know it was. And I was
you're like, I'm not sure if it was Lorenzo's Oil, maybe?
It was.
What?
It was Lorenzo's Oil.
Who did you play?
I didn't play anybody. That's what happened was that they came to scout at my high school for like the young Lorenzo, and I got scouted to like audition with George Miller, and I got really far in the process, and the audition process, which would happen after school, started to conflict with the musical rehearsals. So I was like, do I want to really like quit the musical to go try to be in the movies? And so I did, and then I didn't get the fucking part.
Oh God. Like, how did you deal with that?
I was devastated. It got me down to the way I was auditioning with Susan Sarandon and like Nick Nolte and George Miller.
Have you worked with any of those people subsequently?
I know Susan now, I don't think I've ever talked to Susan about it, actually. That's so funny.
Heads up, Susan Sarandon.
I've got a story for you, Susan.
That's fucking crazy.
Oh my God.
How angry were you?
I was so really horrified that I quit the play. And
that's
didn't
a
get
good
the
education for
yeah. I
life
learned
and
a lot about
business.
Disappointment. That's for sure. Yeah. Rejection. And then I did the spring musical that year, which was The Music Man, in which I was J.C. Squires, the high tenor of the Barbershop Quartet, because my voice had not dropped yet. And then my sophomore year, I was the jester in Once Upon a Mattress.
Oh, classic.
My junior year, I was...
You tall, skinny son of a gun.
Yeah, I was a tall, skinny son of a gun. My junior year was... oh my God, what did we do junior year? I don't remember, but then we did, in my senior year, we did... Oh, yes, I do remember. Junior year was a big year because I won the Gene Kelly Award for Excellence in High School Musical Theater in Pittsburgh for my portrayal of the modern Major General in Pirates of Penzance. And then my senior year in the fall, I did Godspell, and in the spring, I did John Adams in 1776.
Who did you play in Godspell?
I played Judas.
Oh.
Son of a gun.
Yeah.
These are good parts.
Yeah, they were good parts. Good
we're
stuff.
Really showing your stuff.
They're doing 1776 on Broadway next year. I'm like,
can
hello,
you get seen
agents.
For that?
Let's go.
We've talked about this. I like that you're, I don't think people think of you as a singer, but
right.
I like that you're, I hope that you
I
are.
I do too. My degree is in musical theater from Carnegie Mellon, but
you don't
I don't. I chose very, like, I chose not to pursue it. I didn't want to be, I didn't want to do it for some reason back then. I thought,
what about now? What about
now?
What about now?
I
just want to say, while you say that, the things you're doing with your shirt look at are delightful.
I want to do it. You're like, I want to do it.
Put that out in the world.
Yeah, I have. I will. And I will.
Do you have any, like, dream?
Sweeney Todd, dream role.
Yes. I give it the Spark File stamp of approval.
That's been my dream role. Okay, so I don't know. And again, I mean, I'm just rambling. But when I was a Civic Light Opera mini star in the year 19, I want to say it was maybe
1911.
It was either 89 or 90. They did as part of the main stage. So while we were mini stars, we also got, like, I was a munchkin in their main stage production of The Wizard of Oz in 1988, okay, starring Kathy Rigby. I was a page boy in their 1990, they did Oliver. And even though I used Consider Yourself to get into the Civic Light Opera mini stars, I was narrowly not cast as the Artful Dodger. I was instead cast as Charlie Bates. A lot of rejection early for me.
Good.
Like, I had my hopes set on Charlie, on the Artful Dodger, and they gave it to some New York actor. And instead I played Charlie Bates, the sort of second to the Artful Dodger. So like the third fiddle to like Oliver, Charlie Bates, and then the Charlie, or Oliver, Artful Dodger, Charlie Bates. Anyway. And then I was a page boy in the 1992 production of Cinderella. But in the midst of that, they did a production of Sweeney Todd with John Cypher and Karen Morrow.
Oh, God.
And
Karen Morrow is the shit.
Yeah, she was the shit as Mrs. Lovett, let me tell you.
Oh, and my God, I bet she was...
We were invited as the mini stars to the dress rehearsal. So it's an empty theater.
No place you'd rather be.
No, oh it's God. An empty theater in the Benedum Center, which is a really glorious sort of theater in Pittsburgh. And I was sitting, I'll never forget this, I was sitting on the floor in the first row of the mezzanine with my arms up on the sort of like banister, you know what I mean? So I was like leaning over as the overture of Sweeney Todd begins. And I was so engrossed by those, you know, organ notes and like so like lulled into like, what's going to happen? Because this was like early, I hadn't been exposed to much theater at this time. And then that whistle.
The scream of that whistle.
Literally threw me back into the chair. And like there was such a feeling of...
That's visceral, baby.
Like belly fear that I had never experienced anything like it at that point. Like I have goosebumps now just talking about it.
That's how you know it's good.
And then I was... for the next 2.5 hours, just like absolutely glued. So Sweeney Todd, I've seen Sweeney Todd more than any other stage production in my life. And isn't it interesting as well, like to think about the journey that I've been on as an actor and how many of these sort of like dark, villainous, evil characters I've played that like, for me to step into that when it's age appropriate, I still have a few years, but I'm really excited about that somewhere in the world.
I'm so into this. And I also, I want to do the math to see like how, I know Sweeney Todd's had a rough life, so he could be younger and still he would be pretty haggard. How old does he have to be?
I don't know. I mean, Michael Cervar has played it in that Patti LuPone production.
That's
he was probably not much older than I am now. I would want to be 50 myself.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Let's.
Which gives me, you know, the rest of my 40s to.
I'm so there. I'll be there on opening night throwing roses at you.
And also, I feel like we need a moment from Sweeney Todd. Like, it's.
Yeah,
it's
it wasn't that long ago.
Not that long ago, you know, they did it on Broadway. Then they did that, like, Lincoln Center orchestra thing with Emma Thompson. Then they did the one at the Barrow Street, which was sort of site specific. Yeah. And we need a breather.
But then.
Yeah.
Bring it.
Coming in like a freight train.
We need to stop it from happening until you're ready, though.
Thank
we just need to block any other.
I just have faith that if it's meant to be, it'll be. And if it's not meant to be here, it'll be meant to be somewhere.
You know? Can we get Karen Morrow to play Mrs. Lovett?
Oh, my.
She's good.
I have other ideas, darling.
Oh, good. Good. Hold some back. Keep a little mystery.
When I bump into something that inspires me, I dump it in the spark fire. Could be something that I wanna make or how I wanna be. I pump it in my spark file. I jump into my spark file. Let's open up the spark file.
That was part one of our interview with Zachary Quinto.
Part two will be available next week wherever you get your podcasts, unless you're in the future.
Then it's available right now.
So go on and give it a listen and find out what became of the boy known as ZQ.